Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association, honoring Arbor Day on April 26th, with an ongoing commitment to sustainable stewardship and conservation of Missouri's forests. ChooseWood.com.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is St. Louis on the Air.
One of the things Chris corrected me on is that a field in Kansas looks very different than a field in Missouri. I called her and I said, how would you like to write some fake news?
I don't know if unique is the right term. It is not nearly as common, absolutely.
In general, the film industry is still a bit behind the times.
I'm Emily Woodbury. When the short film Liberty premieres at the St. Louis Filmmakers Showcase later this month, it will mark the fruition of a dream nearly three decades in the making. Chris Lawing and his wife, Angie Claire Lawing, met in film school 27 years ago, and together they shared the hope of one day working on a creative project together. Their film Liberty tells the story of a reporter named Zoe Kyle, who applies to a small-town newspaper in Kansas after her career plans were seemingly ruined by a leaked sex tape. Once hired, Zoe gets an assignment to cover a plant expansion by the town's top employer, meatpacker Jack's Beef. And what was initially pitched as a puff piece changes in Zoe's hands.
Everything we'd done been with the town's best interest.
What about accusations of illegal dumping in the Arkansas River?
Investigated and dropped.
In the county's anti-immigration ordinance?
That's what you guys like to call it. Don't see nothing wrong with it. We supported it. If you're legal, you got nothing to worry about.
Then how would you explain the 2013 ICE raids?
These aren't the questions that Allie sent over.
So you have no comment?
Yeah, well, you know how these people are. They're shifty, desperate to be here, and pretty good at lying on the application.
One of your own managers was charged with taking kickbacks from workers. That does not sound like an issue of those people.
That clip is from the short film Liberty, and with me now are its creators, including writer and director Chris Lawing. Chris, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And film's producer, Angie Claire Lawing. Angie, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having us both.
So, Chris, what led you to write about corruption within a meatpacking plant in the Midwest?
Well, it's a longer story in some ways. I mean, I had been a writer an aspiring writer for many, many years, and we had talked about doing a larger project, and my initial script was a 1920s period piece, and Angie told me I had to do something cheaper.
if we were going to get it made.
Costume and set design for the 1920s, that's a big pull.
It is a big, big challenge. But I had been kicking around the character of Zoe in my head for a couple of years. I'm also an avid reader of news, and so there's I'd been following the meatpacking industry even before COVID, when it really got into the public eye. But
workers were bearing the brunt of a lot of COVID-19 infections in these meatpacking plants.
Absolutely, but workers had been exploited by meatpacking companies for years before that. So this is an ongoing issue. I mean, COVID had just simply exposed the faults in our society. But I had looked at this idea of this confluence of characters and this confluence of immigrants and cultures in rural America and the challenges around that, as well as the power that corporate America has over rural America. And so that really kind of, you know, festered in my head for a while, and then somehow I started kind of peeling that apart and came up with Liberty.
In 12 minutes, I feel like Liberty hits on so many aspects of life in rural America, as you mentioned, you know, particularly these small towns. You know, the opening shots of the film depicts cattle grazing, wind turbines, a really gorgeous horizon on an open field. And there's also, you know, a main street with open parking spaces and blinking traffic lights, kind of signaling a place where there was once more activity than there is today. And I wonder, you know, Chris, you're from Kansas and you've lived in St. Louis for 16 years. I feel like there's a lot of love for small town America in this film. And at the same time, there's kind of a recognition of the struggles in these small areas. Was that intentional?
Absolutely. Having grown up in Kansas, I mean, I grew up in Wichita, Kansas, which is the largest town in the state. But at the same point, I'm a grandson of farmers, and I went to school in a small town. So I do have a connection and an affinity and also a fascination of small towns and certainly a love for Kansas. So when we went and filmed those shots and kind of scoped out the locations as well as just concepting the entire piece, I really wanted to try and capture what it was like, not the cartoonish element of it, but more realistic, so that you know the region, the town itself is a character.
Mm-hmm. And this is the town of Fort Liberty.
So that is a fictional town. So okay. Fort Liberty is a fictional town. We were able to film in Pratt for our exterior locations, which is about an hour and a half outside of Wichita and towards western Kansas. But Fort Liberty is an amalgamation of a number of small towns and meatpacking towns in western Kansas.
Yeah, and being from Iowa, I recognize a lot of Iowa towns in the scenes set in Liberty.
Well, I think one of the, you know, I mean, Storm Lake, Iowa, is a great example. And there was actually a major raid, ICE raid, about 10 years ago where half of the town's population was deported. And one of the things that's just really horrible about these instances of these ICE raids is the people that are punished are the workers and not the companies that are hiring the illegal workers. So we're criminalizing the workers and not people profiting off of them.
You know, you mentioned some of the places where you filmed, and you filmed the exteriors in Kansas, and I believe, Angie, you scoped out some locations in the St. Louis area for the interiors. Where did you film in the St. Louis region?
So in St. Louis, we filmed at a actual working plant that we happened to get when they were not running loud and heavy equipment the day of our filming. And that plant happened to be my dad's former plant, Murex Chemical Products. It is now Claritech. That's one of the locations. We filmed at a home in South City. And then we also filmed in Troy, Illinois, at a location that posed as a small-time journalist office that actually was a small-town journalist's office of the Times Tribune in Troy. It was their former office. It had been abandoned, and they had moved offices, but they left amazing amounts of materials, including old newspapers that I have since put aside from the early 1900s that were just sitting in there. And I thought, oh my gosh, this belongs in a local historical society.
Wow. Yeah, that's a treasure trove.
It is. I was like, in the meantime, though, we'll use it for props.
So very nice. So lots of real world props and set design in this.
It is a world of authenticity. And yeah. I learned, you know, you always learn so many things around how to make a fictional world real. One of the things Chris corrected me on is that a field in Kansas looks very different than a field in Missouri, corn versus wheat. And these are the things that matter when you want to build a world that's believable and people can really imagine it to be someplace they drive by on the highway.
I'm Emily Woodbury in for Sarah Fenske. We'll continue this conversation after a short break. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio. Welcome back. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Sarah Fenske. Today I'm talking with the creators of Liberty. This is a short film that tells the story of an intrepid reporter who uncovers corruption and intrigue at a local meatpacking plant in small-town Kansas. The film premieres at the St. Louis Filmmakers Showcase later this week. And with me now is its writer and director, Chris Lawing, and the film's producer, Angie Claire Lawing. Chris, I'd love to hear you speak to the inspiration for your main character. This is reporter Zoe Kyle.
So I drew Zoe from a couple of characters and a couple of experiences. When I was growing up, there was a reporter at one of our local stations, and so this was in the 80s, and she had a sex tape that was leaked, and her career was pretty much ruined. And this was before, you know, sex tapes became kind of something much more common. And it really had impressed upon me this idea of someone that had worked so hard in their entire life and then had this one instance of something that something so private, exposed, and then their entire career and life is just taken away from them. And how do you recover from that? So that was one of the things that I really wanted to kind of explore and meditate on. I think one of the things that's really nice about being a filmmaker as opposed to being a novelist, and some of this is also just probably laziness on my part, is that I'm not the only one exploring that character. So I create kind of the construct of that character, and then I hand it off to someone else. And then that person really starts to, fill that character out.
Is this the actress?
Yes, okay. This is the actress. Yeah. So in that way, there are certain things that I just can't understand or I can't imagine, but I don't necessarily have to, because a lot of that then becomes the role of the actor to do.
And the whole team around them, the production design that gives her, she had her signature notebook, she had a well-thought-out wardrobe, and then she had her mentor. And one of the things we actually did to help the actress understand what it's like to be a journalist is actually to talk to a former journalist, which we did with a longtime Post-Dispatch writer who's retired. And actually, we had her writing some of the faux pieces as well.
Wow. And who's that?
That was Mary Delatch-Lentnard.
Oh, wow.
Which she said the assignment was one of the most bizarre things, because I called her and I said, how would you like to write some fake news?
And when you say fake news, you're talking about articles that she typed up and then,
articles that appeared in past issues of the Fort Liberty Post. Because, again, we wanted to build the world. And mm-hmm. So when we wrote the articles of the ICE raid that Mary wrote, the actual article of the ICE raid, and the character of Zoe was reading those, and then we also created the articles around her sex scandal as though they were real articles published in a real publication. And so when Zoe read all of that, she was like, wow. And then she talked to Mary, who talked about, the insults that Stace gives to Zoe and how hurt that or horrible some of those things were to actually say if you were mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. a longtime journalist. It's offensive. And so you wouldn't know that if you weren't necessarily in that career. So she had pages of notes on her first day on set, like, wow, this is amazing, and this will help my character development so much.
Yeah, that's terrific. And I can speak as a journalist myself. I felt very in tune with Zoe's character. So nice work with that. I would love to talk about the actress who plays Zoe. She, you scored some Hollywood actors for this film. Natasha Coppola Shalom, whose uncle is Nicolas Cage, whose great uncle is director Francis Ford Coppola, plays Zoe, and her editor is played by Dale Soles, who starred in Orange is the New Black She won 3 Screen Actors Guild Awards for ensemble acting. You know, how are you able to pull these castings off not being in that Hollywood sphere?
Well, it's interesting. I think being in production for as long as I've been in production, so I've been doing this for 25 years, you start to, in some ways, there's this, you feel like some things are just out of reach. But the reality is that you reach out to agents, you know, it's a business. So you look to hire people. And, you know, when you make offers, you know, they review the scripts, they review who's involved with it, and, you know, and then they decide whether that's something that they want to be involved with. So in some ways it's not as difficult as you would imagine, but it is risky because you're constantly, you do get turned down. So you are asking people that seem like in some ways they're out of your league. But the reality is they're just artists that want to work on fun projects and cool projects. So you're just presenting that to them and saying, hey, do you want to come do this with us? I mean, the biggest challenge we had really is that we were filming in the time of COVID. We were reaching out to people in February and March. Mass vaccination had not happened yet. I mean, we're still, travel was still really limited. And so it became the double challenge of that was not just, is this, you know, for an actor, is this someone that I want to work with? Is this material that I want to do? It's, do I want to travel? Do I want to take this risk?
It's the logistics.
That turned out to be the bigger problem and the bigger challenge to surmount. But, you know, but we just kept putting ourselves and the material out there. And, you know, and we got those individuals interested, and it was great.
So, Angie and Chris, you know, as we talk about the production of Liberty, we have to mention that you two are real life spouses, husband and wife. And Angie, as you said, your father helped you scope out locations for the film, and your daughter worked as the camera assistant. I mean, what was it like to have this be such a family endeavor?
We always involve family. I'm from a very large family. And I ran Mercury Labs, which is now Mercury Films with Chris, for 14 years. And we've had family that were employed there. This just felt like an extension of what we like to do. And we have relevant talents to put to use here. So for my dad, who's in real estate, he actually knows locations, both commercial and residential. And it was actually a nice way for me to spend time with my dad. I hadn't seen him very much during COVID at all. And so we put on masks and we drove around separately together. And it was his idea to film at the old plant when I was just talking to him. And so this film actually became an opportunity for us to have an excuse to drive around and look at the city. And that was pretty fun. Our daughter is also an aspiring filmmaker herself, and she's in film school. And it seemed very natural for us to involve her. She was home for part of the pandemic and then had some modifications of going back to college. And she loves being part of the film set. And is
that was the thing. I would say one of the things that I was most excited about is we had, you know, we talked about the talent of the cast. The talent behind the camera was really outstanding. One of the real big things that driving forces to make this film was to collaborate with the cinematographer Sevdia Castrati, and so she, I was really excited about Alen working with a woman cinematographer and an accomplished woman cinematographer, and that was a really great thing to watch the two of them work together and to see Alen learn so much from Sevdia, and then also to see Sevdia really appreciate Alen's work ethic. That was fun to watch.
So is that pretty unique still today, having a woman as a cinematographer?
Unique is probably, I don't know if unique is the right term. It is. Mm-hmm. It is not nearly as common. Absolutely.
In general, the film industry is still a bit behind the times.
A bit, yeah.
If you have 20% of women in anything, you're probably ahead of the curve. Mm. One of the things in our script that I thought was unfortunately extremely unique is that to have two of your top three speaking characters be women, it occurs in less than 18% of scripts. There was a cool study that The Pudding did. I don't know if you've ever seen, they do these cool data visualizations. They analyzed over 2,000 scripts on how much dialogue comes from a female character versus a male character. And so 82% of the top several thousand films made over time, the top two characters that speak are men's characters. Okay. And on top of that, even if your top character is a female, like a film like Pocahontas, is only 30-something percent female dialogue.
Wow.
Pocahontas is a story about a female heroine. but 70% of the dialogue is male. And so this is a thing in the industry that really gets me, because it's almost like, well, you could have one of the three characters be women, but we need to surround that woman with lots of men talking, just in case we don't trust that people want to watch a movie that has too many women speaking. And this is a Hollywood mindset thing. And then behind the camera, we have many generations of training and development that is just dominantly male. And there are so many cool programs that are helping to change that, but it's a little bit slow moving. So yeah, 20%. We beat 20%.
We have
a lot of women in this film.
I believe your film also passes the Bechdel test, because the women who are speaking together are not talking about men or romantic endeavors.
Yes, there's lots of gender tropes. And that's one of the cool things that a lot of people who have read the script, a lot of women in particular, love the character of Zoe, because there's so much depth. There's not a romance in this film, in the short film version or the feature film version that we hope to someday make. And that in and of itself is unusual.
You're listening to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Sarah Fenske. And today I'm talking with the creators of the short film Liberty, which premieres this month at the St. Louis Filmmakers Showcase.
So the villain in this story, Jack's beef plant manager, Stace Lamont, he, you know, uses terms like fake news, he decries gotcha journalism, and, you know, at times has pretty offensive things to say about immigrants. You know, with his character, are you offering kind of a commentary on a certain sect of the country?
I don't know if I'm offering a commentary on a certain sect of it. You know, I think what I see is there are people in positions of power that dehumanize their workers. I think that there was a news article last year about a Deadpool run by managers at a meatpacking plant. So I mean, I think that it's easy to fall into the dehumanization. And Stace definitely is the character that I was using to kind of explore that. We are seeing xenophobia all around us. And you know, I mean, this is a country that's been challenged with xenophobia forever. So it's playing out in headlines all over the place, and that was just one of the elements of the character that I wanted to kind of explore.
And the actor who plays Stace, I mean, he plays this villain so well. Has he done similar roles, kind of villainous roles, before?
You know, it's interesting. You know, one of the things I was most excited about working with Jim Beaver was that his role of Ellsworth and Deadwood. And, you know, Ellsworth was such a fantastic character in Deadwood, but he was not a villain.
He was a good guy.
He was a good guy. But Jem is such a fantastic character, actor. I mean, he's such a fantastic actor. He really embodies the characters. And you know, when he showed up at set and he just started reading these lines, you know, I mean, it was like, get out of my head. I mean, this is exactly the way that I imagined Stace. This is exactly the way that I, you know, there was very little direction that I, you know, that we had and that I gave him. He just had it. And it was a little eerie, but it was great. I loved it.
He definitely has played a villain before because we asked him to bring his own boots for wardrobe if he had comfortable boots that he liked. And at one point in the production, I looked at his boot and I said, oh, no, we got blood on your boot. And he said, no, no, that's the last guy I killed. I was like, oh, good. Otherwise, we're going to owe you some boots.
So you mentioned that, you know, you would like to make this one day a feature-length film. And I believe, Chris, you even have the script written for that. What would it take to bring this this story to a feature-length level?
Well, quite simply, money.
Isn't that always the case?
I mean, feature films are, I mean, they are quite an endeavor. And, you know, bringing 30 to 50 people together for 4 weeks' time, and even if you raise all the funds you need to raise, it's a labor of love. We initially set out, I mean, the goal of this project of Liberty was a feature, and so we wrote it as a feature-length film, and we're in the process of going through the development funds, but we decided that we needed to kind of shape the vision of the film, and so that's where the short film really came out, was pulling together a team to collaborate to shape the vision so that can really dictate what the feature is going to be like.
And once Chris decided, let's test the vision, then I thought, well, why not make it bigger and let's test some other things? Let's bring in some people we haven't worked with before, including Bass Casting, who helped with several of the key roles. And then we had a new production designer. We had many people that we have worked with that we brought in from out of town that we've done lots of corporate and commercial projects with. And, you know, a film is a major collaboration, so it's nice to bring people together and see how we all are working together and sort of get that flow going before we're under the gun with, you know, 22 days. Here's how many pages per day. You know, sets need to be built. And I think having this as both a piece to show to potential investors, like, how about investing in an entertainment piece? You know, in St. Louis in general, we have a lot of opportunity to do more. But I think there's also this craving as collaborators, like, let's just go do it and let's bring a team together and let's try some things and see what we think. And will that change or improve this bigger piece that is multiple years of work, regardless of indie or not? A film is a major commitment.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, the 12-minute version of Liberty, it's a great watch. It will premiere at the St. Louis Filmmakers Showcase, which runs from this Friday to Sunday, July 25th. Chris and Angie, what's the best way to make sure to view the film as part of the festival to find out more information?
You can buy tickets now at cinemastlouis.org, and you'll be available to watch the film on Friday. And all the way through.
And that's on demand, kind of at your leisure.
Absolutely.
Yep. Okay, interesting. Well, Chris Lawing, writer and director of Liberty, and the film's producer, Angie Claire Lawing, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thanks so much for having us.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thank you.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association, honoring Arbor Day on April 26th, with an ongoing commitment to sustainable stewardship and conservation of Missouri's forests. ChooseWood.com.